So I get asked a lot, being in my 40s, how do I manage to continue to perform all season long at the level that I do? Well, you know, it's a lot of hard work, but I have a lot of help. Triple Threat Performance has been putting this old body back together again for years. I keep tearing it down, and they keep putting me back together. And now, apart from the physical therapy side, I got involved in their athletic training program. And honestly, I don't think the Mountains stand a chance this season. So if you're in the Phoenix area and you're interested in upping your game, check them out at www.ttpaz.com. That's ttpaz.com. Hey guys, I want to take a few moments to thank Sneak Tech Sneak Boots for their support of the show. They make it possible for me to keep it free, so please go check them out at sneaktech.com. Thank you. Now let's roll into the next episode.
Hi, welcome to the Interviews with the Hunting Masters, brought to you by the Sneak Tech Sneak Boot and Phoenix Shooting Bags. So I am trying to bang out a few elk podcasts here before elk season starts. Kind of got give you guys a leg up, and I brought Paul Metal back on with us, the Elk Nut. He was on the show last season. And we talked a lot about calling elk and different dialogue that the elk are having, and how to kind of judge what they're saying and be able to communicate back to them, so you're not just willy-nilly, you know, making sounds and not knowing what the hell you're saying. Because if this guy, if the elk is saying, hey, I'm looking for cows, and you say, hey, I want to fight you, it might not be what you need to be saying at that time. So anyway, that's a really good podcast. If you want to go back and look at that, I'll put that in the show notes. But without further ado, Paul, how are you doing today?
Hey, I'm doing great, John. Thanks a bunch for having me back on.
Yeah, absolutely. Last podcast we did was, I believe it's definitely in my top 10 most downloaded. So it was a very popular one. You had really good information, and I always enjoy listening to you. I love your approach to it. You don't, for some people it might be a little much because you don't simplify it, and it's a lot, but I enjoy that. I like the in-depth approach that you have to hunting elk. It's not like, oh, I just go out there and, you know, challenge them and that's it, you know, type situation. I like that you've been a student of elk, and not only that, you're a good teacher of it. There's a lot of guys out there that are excellent hunters, but they don't know how to tell people what they do.
That's a real good point too, and it really is so true. And there are a lot of really good hunters out there, whether it's elk hunters, deer hunters, moose hunters. But a lot of them have trouble getting their point across, or just don't want to share, period.
That's true.
You know, because of the trial and errors they went through and the school of hard knocks. And so they have a lot of reasons, you know, behind that. But you're right about the first podcast. And we'll probably even touch a little bit on some of those more important tactics or sequences mm-hmm. that can apply, you know, here or in the last one. And that's what's important. And it's funny you mentioned how I don't simplify things maybe like some. To me, they are simple. They're very basic and simple. And so maybe I do talk over people's heads at times, but let's see what I can do about making it even more understandable right now.
Yeah. Well, this podcast, we're a lot of the questions I've gotten in the last few months have been about, and you and I talked like 2 minutes before we got on here about how some of these questions are seem really basic to somebody like you and myself that have been hunting elk for a long time. But these are the questions that guys have. These are like, they may not have the same foundation or understanding. And so we're going to try to fill in those pieces, and then round them out with these, stuff that Paul hammers home with all the time. So, but real quick before we get into any of these questions, just give me a quick brief bio, just in case nobody knows, or not nobody knows, or no, nobody, or excuse me, my God, my brain is off today. The people that are on here that didn't hear you last time, and just to give you an understanding of who you are and what you do.
Yeah, no problem. Yeah, as far as those who aren't familiar with ElkNet Outdoors, and that's who I'm representing here as the owner of ElkNet Outdoors, is our basic whole thing of teaching is helping individuals to understand the elk language. And it has led to a bunch of success towards that for us, as well as everyone we've shared this with for almost 20 years now. And of course, it's like anything, you learn new things all the time. It's or your mind is being refreshed on some of these sounds, things that maybe you had taken for granted for a while. Speaking of myself, and as I continue to evolve with the elk, and especially talking about over-the-counter elk, the ones that are being hammered all the time by hunters or by wolves, the predators. And so when you have those different challenges out there, sometimes we have to make adjustments on our end to be able to still fit in and call these elk in. When people say you're calling elk, they think we're out there just bugling and cow calling everywhere, and they come running to us, and it's not like that. And that's why I say, maybe it is simple, but maybe it's not. And I don't want to get too deep into that, but it's the fact that once you understand that core you're after, no matter what kind of pressure he's seeing or she's seeing, you start getting a good feel of how to inject the right sounds or a right sequence at that time. And sometimes the right response is nothing at all. It depends on the situation.
This happens to be like, and I not just for elk, but for deer and everything else. This happens to be like the number one question I get. I probably, if I had a dollar bill for every time this question gets sent over to me, I still wouldn't be rich, but I would be a lot better off. Anyway, so I always get this, and I tend to ask this question a lot: is when hunting a new area, what are some of the things that you do to pick your pick your spot. What are you looking for? What do you or when you're pulling out a map, even before you got boots on the ground, anything, what are the things that you're looking for, or what are the things that stand out to you that say, hey, I'm gonna find elk here?
I look for country that nobody wants to hunt. That's number one for me. And the country that I'm capable of still negotiating. And so to me, that's an important factor. If somebody were to call, one of the fish and wildlife agencies, there it seems like that they're always asking how many elk are there, how much pressure is there, how big are the bulls? Where are the elk? And those are really not good questions to ask, because everybody asks them that. And so you need to do your homework as far as what it takes to find and put elk on the ground. But as far as what I'm looking for mainly is I'm trying to find areas that are void of trails and roads. And I want rough country. I want steep country, because most people won't even give it a second look. They drive right by it. And they don't want to mess with it, because most of them aren't in the physical capacity to be able to endure a mountain like that day after day after day. And so, being physically fit and elk hunting almost go hand in hand if you're a runner and gunner. If you're a tree stand guy and you just want to dink around and sit around water, wallows, trails, and that's okay. But for individuals that want that ultimate challenge, Western challenge, and it's calling elk. They want to hear bulls bugling. I look for country where elk should inhabit, and just rough country that maybe they're in locally, or they get pushed to from these trails or roads that people aren't going into. And those are just aren't words, John. This is what we do every year. We find those areas, and it doesn't matter where we hunt, and they're full of elk. When I say they're full of elk, I mean there's an elk, a herd of elk in there, and I'm not meaning 20 bulls, but I mean there may be one or two. To me, that's good on an over-the-counter hunt, because once I find the elk, I just need one bull. I don't need 10 bulls to call one in. I just want that one. And
Right.
so you can fill your tag with that one by going through some of the strategies we may cover here.
Nice. So I'm gonna stay on this question for a little bit. Even though you answered it very
No, go
well,
ahead, because sometimes I elude things a little bit.
I think. And I think map reading is an art form, and I think it's kind of one, it's kind of been lost. And not just maps, even looking at Google Earth and aerial type stuff. When you're using those tools, do you have like a checklist or something that you kind of like, and I'm sure it might even just be a mental thing for you now. It's not like you got a physical checklist. I know myself, I don't have that paper checklist anymore because I see something and I'm like, oh, that's what I'm looking for, you know? But if you could almost kind of put it in like a, you said steep and rough and maybe you're away from roads or whatever, but what are those other like landscape features or elk needs that you can identify on a map or aerial that can help them and how do you find them?
Well, you know, obviously on topographical maps, their lines will separate or get closer together on steepness and ruggedness. So when I'm talking steep, I can easily find benches on it where the lines start separating. But when you're talking steep country, let's just say we start, Idaho is very famous with your elk country is going to be between 5,500 and 8,000 feet. And that's real common here. You know, that's 8,000 is just starting in some states, but that's how it is here. And a lot of the states I hunt, and I've hunted seven different states, and it seems like 9,500 feet, I believe, is about the highest I've ever been. I've never had to go any higher than that and get into elk. But when I'm looking at steep, I could be driving down a dirt road and I see the mountains on the left and right side of me. No trails, no roads, a creek may be running on one side or the other, real common, and no matter where you hunt, when it's steep like that. And when you look off, it's almost intimidating to most people. But when I see it, I look, okay, all I have to do, I don't even have to go a mile. I know I don't have to, from years of experience, that once I get up there, it's going to start benching on its own. It just does. And there's no mountain that just goes straight up and doesn't bench. They just don't. And an elk only needs, I mean, 10, 15 feet of a level spot. That's all they need. And if anything additional to that is just a bonus. And what you're going to find is on these benches is these elk travel these benches. Very rare do you see them just go straight up and straight down because they got nothing to do. They take those easiest routes just like we do. And if we're going up a mountain, a lot of times we do our own little switchbacking or we go into an angle. We don't just go straight up unless we have to. But they're taking the easiest transition up it. And once you hit these benches, that's where I start hitting the elk sign. I may see a trail going up. But once it hits the bench, they shoot off on these benches and they may walk it a ways and then go up again to the next one or the next one. So I look for these benches and this is where we take a lot of these elk are right on those benches. And sometimes those benches will have water on them just out of nowhere. I mean, they'll seep from under the ground. It's not like there's a creek feeding them that's visible. And so seeing these things year after year all over the place, I seek these areas out. Where most people are starting on dirt roads or they're starting on trailheads, and so they're concerned about outdistancing everybody so that they're into more natural surroundings where the elk aren't being too pressured or pushed completely out of an area. Now, this doesn't mean you should never take a trail, you know, because they're good for going in at dark and branching off into areas that if somebody was using the trail and calling, that they couldn't hear these elk if they get over the next hill or mountain there. And so, you know, those are fine, but I prefer not to use any trails because it just pays off very well. And I know when I hear an elk, generally, it's not a hunter. And so, because I've removed myself from that from the equation, there's no people over in this area, or they'd be parked where I am. There is no other access. And so that gives me that comfort that no matter what I get up into over there, that when I do get into elk or I hear anything, I know it's elk. The odds are very high that it's an elk. And so that's what I look for in that steep country. And I really don't use Google Earth or anything like that to any extent. On areas I'm unfamiliar with, I will get the maps of that area. And I only use a certain map. I don't use just any map. I like the 7.5 1 in 24,000 maps because they're USGS, but they're UTM grid. They're not okay. Longitude, latitude, and that is the map of our choice, the five of us in the ElkNet team. We use that because it's for ground navigation, not aerial. And so it's very detailed. And by going over those maps, I can easily see where a trail may go or an old skid road went at one time. And then I can move myself away from those areas and move just a drainage away from them is all it takes. You don't need to be miles away. All I need to be is wherever somebody's on that trail, they could not hear me or elk from this spot right here. And it may be just a little pocket. It may be a little small basin. And then it levels out and my topographical lines now are getting further and further apart, which shows me it's kind of like park-like in there. It's a flat spot. It could be an area elk are using to feed. And so, you know, I look for little things like that. And when you look on a map, you'll find hundreds of them. They're everywhere.
Right.
Over the place. And so finding the elk, I'm going to do it vocally. That's how I'm going to find them. Once I get into my area or I start going into it, I'm going to start calling. And I'm going to have them give themselves away. I'm not trying to call them to me. I just need them to give me their position.
Right. Exactly. No, it makes perfect sense. Yeah, you started off saying something that not a lot of people understand it. Even though deer and elk and pretty much any animal can navigate the mountain far more efficiently than we do.
Oh, yeah.
They are designed to conserve energy. So they're always, almost always going to take the path of least resistance unless they're being chased or something
exactly.
like that. And then they're going to run whatever. It's funny, and I did this with elk too. A little trick I learned back in the day was I used to make a cinch point when I came across cattle fencing or barbed wire fence, and I would cinch it down from the top wire and the bottom wire and create a place for deer to pass under and elk or larger deer to jump over. And every time I found a trail that ran alongside a fence and I did that, all of a sudden that trail turned, made a hard left or a hard right to jump over that fence right there. And I'd always, like, when I'd set up trail cameras, I mean, you'd see elk and deer just, boom, they go right to there. Because why? They're traveling along that fence to the spot that they would normally cross or whatever. So they found a nice, easy spot to do. It's just an example of, you know, what you're saying about them.
That's exactly, it's true. And I've done the same thing or something similar. A lot of the country we hunt, there are no fences anywhere.
Yeah.
And so, but I've also, you know, tried to renegotiate their path if they're coming to a water area, because there are times when I will sit around water and I can see where they're going where I would have no opportunity. So I would just throw so much debris and garbage in the way that I forced them to come a different route, which would put them with wind in my favor, and they have to now, to get to that destination, they have to reroute. And, you know, animals will do that. They have trees fall and rocks move, and it's not a big deal. How many times you went across trails or walking into areas you've hunted in the past and trees have fallen everywhere, you know, from
the
wind.
There's a little jog around it, and that's it, and it gets passed on the trail.
And you can create those things as a hunter if the area warrants it and you're finding something that's worth going back into. So, yeah, those are just little things, but they can certainly help notch a tag sometimes.
Yeah. I don't want to hammer this too much, but this is a nice little story real quick. I actually, it was a blowdown. There was a fire and then a microburst came through there and all this stuff fell. And it was, you know, so just trees laying all over the place and just super hard to navigate. And I went in there one summer with my chainsaw and I literally cut a path through it. I cut a path from where they were bedding, kind of straight. Like, I mean, I basically cut the corner of this blowdown area, and I set up a tree stand on the opposite end. And I tell you, every single deer and elk that came into there passed through right there, because why are they going to step over all these trees and whatnot when they got this nice path that John cut for them, you know? But
No, I've done similar things, exactly, and it wasn't for the elk so much, it was for me, so I could get through. But then they use it, yes. They will definitely use those spots that you've carved out so that you can get to your stand, you know, being not noticed, because that's a big thing to be able to get in and get out without them knowing your area, if that's something you plan to hunt over and over. Because all it takes is one time, if you're near their bedding area, especially if you're somewhere there they frequent and it is a destination spot, not a transition area where they're going to and from and you're in the middle, you can bump them there many times and they'll keep coming back. But you get near that right at the feeding or bedding and you bump them out of there from scent or sightings, and many times they just won't come back. That's it. They're done for weeks on end.
Right.
So that's real crucial to be able to get to those areas if you're going to sit like that and spend some time, not to booger them out of there, or you're going to be sitting there for want.
Yeah, absolutely. So you started to mention once you've picked your spot and you see in sign or whatever that you're going to locate elk vocally. So what are some of the things that you do when one, obviously, you know, to get them to answer back or whatever. But once they've started answering back, how do you take the temperature of the situation to determine, you know, how you're going to start approaching this elk?
Well, first of all, I hope the elk say something on their own, you know, seriously. And I don't just jump out and start calling. I usually will get into an area first, unless I'm just night calling along a road trying to have elk give away their position. But as far as getting out and hunting the area, I look for them to say something first. And I listen intently, because it's so, you know, when elk are giving a sound, a bugle or a cow call, everything is on emotion. That's what it's about. It's just like your dog. If your dog started to bark every 30 seconds to a minute, it really means nothing to you. You're just being annoying. He's barking. But if your dog started to speed up that bark, and all of a sudden now you're taking notice that there's something out there. I mean, he's no longer just giving these, you know, these lazy barks. He's now kind of giving that, you know, hey, there's something there. You know, whether it's another dog or cat, or now he's throwing a growl into it. But you notice how he's changing his tone or his emotion. This is what elk do. They do the identical thing. So when I hear a bugle, or if I'm going to incorporate a bugle, I'm not going to be challenging in my bugle. I especially if they're not saying much, all I'm trying to do is get them to give their position away. So when an elk bugles either on its own or responds back to me, I'm listening to the emotion of that bugle. It means everything to me. It shows me how I'm going to pull that bull in. There's two ways to hunt elk, John. That's it. Two ways.
Okay.
You either hunt them aggressively once you're calling, or you have to slow play them. There is no in between. There are methods that apply to each of those two tactics. You see how you might approach one. So what I'm listening for is the emotion of the elk. If I get something to fire back at me with a grunt or two and a challenging scream, I know he's got a hot cow. So see, he immediately is aggressive. But the hardest bull to call in and to put on the ground is the one that gives you a lazy, lethargic bugle. And this means in response, or he does it on his own. That is the bull that survives most every single hunter out there. And because he won't answer back. He doesn't say anything. He may not say anything for 10 or 15 minutes, and you're already a half a mile down the ridge because you couldn't get him to say anything to a bugle or a cow call or both. He doesn't say anything. But that bull is so callable. And I'm going to pull him in. I'm not bragging or nothing, but I will pull that bull in 90% of the time. But I know I have to slow play him. But how am I end up killing him? 9 times out of 10, through aggressive action. But I'm going to climb the ladder. But I have to play the game. I have to get him fired up. I know his temperature, just as you mentioned, is all the way on cold, just like your vehicle on a cold morning. It's sitting on C.
Right.
And no matter what you do, there's nothing you can do at that point to make it come up all the way to hot or halfway so you have a heater. It isn't going to do anything. No matter how hard you want to hit the pedal, it takes time for that to warm up. This is what I'm going to do with that bull. as he answers me back with the bugle, let's just say I get something like this. He's either on his own. I'm going to give a sound here if that's okay with you.
Yep. I'm going to pull my headphones off my head for a second.
No, this is a lethargic, lazy bugle that guys will hear. You can hear it any time of the month, but it's mostly early season, the first 10 days, and you may hear a bugle like this. That's it. Nothing else.
Oh, I didn't even hear it.
Yeah, it's just that low. But the point is that most people hear that and watch all the different videos, even some of the newest ones out there, and they immediately challenge that bull. They may throw a couple cow sounds out, and then they're challenging the bull immediately. And that's one of their biggest mistakes.
I'm actually going to ask you to do that call again. You know why? Because you're wearing your headset, right? So your
mic is right at your
– so the sound's coming out of your bugle tube. I bet you – I didn't hear it at all.
Okay.
I didn't hear it.
Are you kidding me? You never heard that, huh?
No, I mean, I didn't. Yeah, when you did it, I didn't hear it.
Okay, if I did a cow sound right here, can you hear this?
Yep, absolutely.
Okay, that's because that microphone is sitting right here. So.
Right.
Okay, maybe let me try this again.
I know what you do is take your headphones off, put them down in front of you, and bugle at it.
Gotcha. Okay, did you hear that one?
It sounded like a little...
No, it was actually just a very short bugle that lasted about 1 second. So apparently we just can't hear it that well on your end. That's okay.
Yeah, that's...
But they're really lazy bugles, and most hunters who've been out there, they know what I'm referring to. It's just a very short, lazy bugle with hardly any volume. On
right.
a scale of 1 to 10, it'd be a 2 or a 3. And you can tell there's no aggression. No more than a dog growling as a dog comes up and faces him behind the fence, and he starts getting infuriated, and so he's threatening or intimidating that dog to stay back. You see, now that's an aggressive action right there. And if that dog keeps coming closer and closer, your dog will get even more challenging with that animal. And this is what elk will do. So when you have this bull that gives a sound like that, you have to slow play that bull. You must slow play him if you're going to call him in. And so, and that's, like I say, that's the hardest bull to call in right there, because most people want to start going straight to cow calling. And this bull already knows that there's really nothing in the area that's in estrus. No cows are in estrus. Oh, yeah. There'd be bugling going everywhere competitively for this cow. And so knowing that this isn't happening at that time, I am going to play on that bull's curiosity. That's exactly what I'm going to do, and I'm going to pull that bull in almost every single time. And until people see it actually happen time and time again, they're like, I've walked away from 100 bulls in my life that I could have probably done something with, that I just thought he left, or he was not interested, and who knows, drifted away. They don't know. Sometimes they think they chase him away, but most elk never move. They stay right there. Unless they see you or wind you, they have not moved. They're right there in that same spot. And so leaving them, looking for a bull that is more cooperative to your calling, means you could go three, four, 5 miles before you get to another one. Well, if I'm only a half mile, I'd rather get that bull right there at a half a mile than 4 or 5 miles. And so that's why it's so important for us, one of the reasons, to call in any bull that will make a sound on its own or will respond to us. And again, it's the emotion of the sound. Whatever he says is telling me his attitude, his feeling for that moment right there. And so I know what I can play on now. I know I can't give him both barrels. There's no way I'm going to get aggressive with that bull off the get-go. But I eventually, through the sequence, which will take you 15 to 30 minutes to call that bull in. It's just that's what you have to expect. And so once you understand that in your mind, that this isn't something that's going to happen rapidly, then you can slow down and you can exercise that patience that's needed. And you're going to call him in. He probably won't say a word in most cases, but you can call that bull in. Once in a blue moon, I will get him to respond back after 10, 15 minutes. But that's it. And in most cases, I can tell he hasn't moved. He's right there. Then there's the case of a bull that makes a sound like that, and he answers in a minute and a half, and he's cut the distance in half. So see, when I'm calling like that, I don't move on that bull. When he gives me that sound, and before I decide to make a sound myself, I know I'm not going to advance on that bull until I hear him again. because I need to know if he moved or not.
That's
so, you
important.
Know, yeah, it's slow playing these bulls. I mean, that's what you're doing so that you can call a non-aggressive bull to you. And the way I'm basically going to call him is I'm going to eventually, after a few minutes, I'm going to convince him that I have a cow that's coming into heat. And that is exactly how I'm going to get that bull in. That's the whole thing behind hunting September and October anyway. But right. I can't do it right off the bat. He's not stupid. You know, these guys see everything out there. And again, I'm talking, you know, basically do-it-yourself over-the-counter public land bulls here. And so you have to slow it down, slow play that bull. And you can call nearly every one of these in. You really can. And once you start calling one or two in, you'll start gaining that confidence that this can happen. If we were sitting there in person and I was demonstrating to you like I do at seminars, I would go through the scenario because I know you can't hear the sound here. And you would see what I'm talking about and how I slowly inject that cow into it. I don't give it to him right off. I slowly inject it. And by starting to rake after I've given a couple of cow calls, this bull that heard me, he knows I'm not talking to him. He knows I'm displaying for this cow.
Right.
And I'm displaying for her because she's starting to show signs of coming into estrus, and I'm getting excited about it. I can smell her. And so I'm planting that seed. And so if this bull starts to bugle this at any time, I immediately will now give him a challenge of about a 4 or 5. I need to be able to escalate my challenge or my warning as needed. So when he answers, I immediately will come over him with just more of a, you know, nothing 4 seconds long with the longest lip ball he ever heard with 5 grunts behind it. No, I'm just going to give him that real quick warning, stay back. And this immediately is perking this bull up because bulls know they're the only ones that can translate a cow is coming into heat. Cows don't make any sound at all when they're coming into estrus. None. Zero. Only the bull does.
Right.
And through glunking, through panting, through raking, his short little growls and moans. I mean, he's feeling it right there. His testosterone level is just right. She's coming in. He's interested. And any bull out there that hears this little sequence knows what's going on. They themselves go through it all the time. So they read that, and this is what can promote them to come your way. I mean, the laziest bull bugle you ever heard. Give him time and keep playing it. And there's times, you will get a bull as he's coming in. He will bugle maybe every 90 seconds. But he's only covering 15, 20 feet at a time. He's not coming very hard. And then he'll bugle again. And listen to him. And you'll notice he's bugling for that cow to come to him. He's not bugling. He's not challenging the other bull until he gets much closer. But he'll kind of give you that short roundup bugle. And he's trying to pull her around. And as soon as he gets close enough, that's when I will throw the contact buzz and tell him to come over. I want him to come over. I'm considering him as a possible breeder, not the bull I'm with. And when I play that game, I'm telling you, now as he starts getting more frequent with his bugle, and many times they will, that is when I can get more aggressive with mine, and here he comes. From a bull that gave the most lethargic bugle 20, 25 minutes before, is now so fired up, because he wants to come and scent check that cow. That's what he wants to do. And it'll pull him right in. And when I say pull him in, it usually will pull him in under 30 yards and with the right setup, you know, so he can't see in where you're set up and producing your sequence. You can't give him that luxury of allowing them to be able to see where the sounds are coming from. He must keep coming forward until he gets to a spot where he can physically see something, and then it's too late. He's in my range. But something as simple as that, and once you see it work, I'll use that same sequence over and over and over again for the same or similar bull as that. I will not use that on a herd bull. It won't be nearly as effective because he doesn't want to leave his cows, especially when I'm talking about a herd bull, I'm talking about one that has a hot cow. He's not going to come. You have to take it to him. And so there's the difference right there of slow playing a bull that came out with the laziest bugle you ever heard. It could even been mistaken for a hunter, as opposed to a bull who comes out very, very aggressively.
So I just want to, I don't want to really simplify it, but I'm going to try to So you hear this bull, lazy bugle. And if I understood what you said, you basically, well, do some,
Boy, it was that simple, huh?
do some elk, some bull talking to cow type sounds, basically. And then you'll shut up, you won't move, you won't go at him, and you'll wait till he answers back before you issue him any type of warning.
Yeah, I issue no warning at all unless he responds. None.
Exactly. So what just spell it out for me again. What you kind of said, you said pants and grunts and stuff like that. Is that those are the sounds you immediately make after you hear this
No.
bull make this sound, or
No.
okay.
No.
Go ahead.
Again,
Explain it to me.
okay.
I might be maybe because I missed it, and or I'm just stupid. But go ahead
No, you're not. Okay, so first
and.
of all, you have to understand what each sound represents. So let's just cover that really quick. I'm not going to elaborate deeply on it by any means. Okay, a pant. When a bull or a cow hears an animal pant, it denotes excitement. Okay, so that's the key right behind that sound right there. It doesn't do anything else for other animals, for elk. They know what it means. When they use a pant, which is kind of a That's what they'll do. They'll breathe very heavily, and it's showing that they're excited over a situation or something that's present right in front of them, not something at a great distance. So a pant exhibits excitement. Now, if I'm going to glunking is a bull using this sound as a cow nears estrus or is in estrus, and he's actually trying to taste the air to an extent. And he's showing dominance at the same time. Most bulls that glunk are usually more of a dominant featured bull. At least they feel they are. Any bull can glunk, but they'll start glunking as they taste the air because this cow is coming into heat. And so you're using the right sounds that a bull would use, a real bull would use, as he is right in the presence of a cow coming in. Even other bulls that can smell and circle a herd. And they can smell this cow as the wind comes in their face. They get excited, and you'll hear them do some pants. And they're not just giving these big old aggressive challenging bugles, not at all. They're testing the situation. They're scent checking her. They're showing excitement over it because they have the same urges as the herd bull. And so they exhibit those sounds right there. You hear them kind of glunk and give these soft pants, and they start raking. And they're displaying. They're trying to show off to the lady right there to try to draw her over. Well, I have this one right here. So I'm displaying for her through these sounds. You see, and this all puts it together to this elk over here that I'm drawing on his curiosity that I've got a hot cow right here, one that's coming in. Well, what does he want to do? He doesn't necessarily want to come over and take the cow.
Right.
But he could if he could. Let's put it that way. But he
Right, of
still
course.
wants to come over and smell this situation. He wants to be a part of it. He wants to come around this because this is what he's waiting for. Period. Every bull out there is. And so by making this convenient for him, and you start getting inside, and you don't have to be that close. I call so many bulls in the 125 to 200 yard range by never moving with that sequence right there. I don't move an inch. I stay right there. And I'm working non-herd bulls, though, in most cases. But a lot of them are 6 points. They just don't
Right.
happen to have cows. And
Right,
so
right.
most of them are fives and sixes. And the reason I like doing a sequence like that, John, is because hardly ever does a spike or a cow show up. They just don't come. And so I like tailoring my calling to bulls I'm willing to take. Now, if I just wanted to call that bull in with something else, I could go to a cold calling sequence or a blind cold calling sequence, which means I'm going through an array of cow sounds, like there's three or four cows there and small bull bugles, and I just keep it up, every 5, 6 minutes, rest it a few minutes, start it up again. But that works great on pulling elk in, but rarely does it pull the bull in first. It pulls cows and spikes in first, almost every time. And so I kind of shy away from it because I'm not interested in my terms, the unwanted elk. So I try to tailor my calling to pull that bull or any bull in the area in to that sequence. So if you're a newer hunter and you're just trying to pull in any elk and anything brown is great for you, and you're in an area that where that's legal, your cold calling sequence is number one because it'll pull in any elk. And
Right.
there's a lot more cows and spikes out there than there are 5 and 6 point bulls by a mile. So your odds raise incredibly to have at least a close encounter with an elk. Whereas 5 and 6 points, that sequence right there, which is kind of a low-keyed breeding sequence, is what it is. This is what you're trying to tell this other elk out there, is that you have a lady coming into heat. And that is why it's so effective. And it can work on herd bulls, don't get me wrong. It's just that the sidelights usually will show first. But if I have a herd bull that's aggressive and he's fired up, I know I have to take it to him. I got to get as close as I can. And sometimes, when he answers the cow call, that's all I stay with. I don't go right back to a bugle at all because I love running at him because they stay right there waiting for the cow to come. I mean, you're shooting at point blank range with your bow. And so that's just one of the tactics that would be under aggressive tactics. You see an aggressive
Right.
situation. Another one could be, yeah, you could go in there and bugle and challenge or try to call the cow away that you know is hot in that group. And again, the bull is changing his emotion. That's what he's doing. He's changing his emotion in the call, in the bugle. He's not running in there with a location bugle. He may have contacted with the location bugle, but now as he gets in there tight, now all of a sudden he shortens everything up. His emotion is rising, like you're arguing with a guy at 100 yards away, and your voices are raising. Now you're 50, now you're 40, now you're 10 feet, and you guys are just. You're coming to blows. I mean, you're getting louder and meaner. That's how what the elk will do with emotion. Their sounds shorten and have more power behind them as they close that distance. And so listen to that bull. That's what tells you the story right there. Where is he at? And I mean, this is what kills them. There is no question. I know a lot of people that will use emotion, but they don't know what they're doing with it. They're because you can tell they're using too much aggression on every instance, way too much. And those right there are the elk they're not calling in. And I mean, I have some of these top guys out there, and you know them as well as I do, that have questioned, wanting to know, what are you doing, Paul? How are you bringing these guys in? We can call these kind in, but how are you bringing in these other ones? And that's what I'm doing is I start slow playing the bulls that need to be slow played, and then I go to aggressive tactics on the ones that require aggressive right out of the chute. So it all depends on the bull himself. And if you're in doubt, start with slow play because you can always go up. If you start aggressive, it's hard to come back down and be convincing. It just doesn't work that way. And it's really easy to tell when a bull has a hot cow because there's usually multiple bulls bugling. Or if you have a bull that's just looking for cows, like you mentioned in the beginning of the podcast, this is one of the biggest mistakes hunters make right here. They don't understand what they're hearing. For instance, when you have a bull and you're walking up the mountain and you haven't hardly even bugled yet and you hear a bull bugling and he's bugled 3, 4, 5, 6 times in 10 minutes as you're continually trying to get into the area where he's at because he's a distance away from you and nothing's answering him. See, this bull's looking for cows and he's holding his position and he's trying to draw them to him. Now, for you to get in there and give a couple cow calls and then bugle over that bull, you are rarely ever going to kill that bull. I mean, the odds are under 10%. So why not play on the 90%? You see, that's that's when you need to give the bull what he's asking for. And see, a lot of people don't understand that. They just hear a bull given a bugle. And to them, it's give some cow calls, bugle over the top of them. I do that too. And it works on a lot of bulls. But it doesn't work on every bull. So I'm willing to adjust to maximize my efforts and my success ratio to give that bull and tailor my calling to that guy that I know that this other one isn't going to work on. And that is what I try to do. And this is why we call 90% of the bulls in. I mean, it doesn't matter where we go. We will call bull after bull after bull after bull in. And until guys have been with us and they actually see it, it's just like they wonder why they never thought of it. Because it really isn't that technical. It's just a matter of playing that curiosity card and being able to trump it as is necessary, but you don't want to overdo it and then overcall or get over aggressive before that bull is ready. You have to let him know where he's at, and you're going to see his temperature rise as you play with him in that 15, 20 minute, and you don't see anything. We're talking dark timber here. All you do is hear. I'm not seeing anything standing out in the sagebrush flat here or something. You see nothing. You're going all on that tone or the emotion of that sound. And so you try to work him up. And one of the ways you'll know you're working the bull up is his bugling or his grunt or chuckle is more frequent. It's coming closer together now. Before it was like 5 and 6 minutes apart. Now all of a sudden he's doing it 1 minute apart or 30 seconds or whatever it is. And so That's how you can tell you're starting to raise his temperature right there, is you look for those little things, and that means you increase your volume as well and shorten things up. You see, that's the communication part right there. So, but people always want to try to overdo it. They want to give it, always be bigger than what that bull is, you know, and you don't need to do that because you lose too many of them. And anyway, that's kind of the method to the madness right there. But reading that emotion.
Yeah, you know, that's...
It's so hard to do for some people. And John, this is why I put titles behind them. You know, you get how easy it to say, well, when you're calling a bull, give him number three of emotion. Or give this, no, not that much emotion. Nope, a little bit more. No, it's easier to say, give him a lip ball. And this lip ball, where does that represent in the scale of emotion? It's at the very top. It's one of the top two. When you hear a bull giving a lip ball, it is the ultimate, I'm ticked off, challenge, a scolding. It can be anywhere up there. You see, it's like if you were yelling at your friend or yelling at your son, a youngster. You see, you're kind of scolding him, but you're really not scolding the grown-up. You might be yelling at him, pissed off. So right. See, you're still raising your voice, but for different reasons. And people ask me all the time, do you think a bull will use a challenging type scream or a grunt on a cow? Absolutely. It's the same as you would yell at your wife or your best buddy. It doesn't matter. It's the emotion of the sound. So many times people get into this trap of thinking that this sound represents this message only. No, it's a representation of their emotion, of the sound for the situation they're in. They could scold a hot cow because she is not paying attention to his advances. And for her to get back over here, she's getting too far out, and now he can't see her. Yeah, he could grunt her. He could throw a lip ball. He could scream. He could say, use those same sounds on a bull, though. No different. It depends on the situation. So read that emotion and play on it, because that's what's so convincing to the other elk. You know, a bull can give you a lip ball when you give a lip ball. But does a bull give a lip ball when he's trying to draw or call a cow away from another bull? Yeah, he can show that kind of emotion, but the bull could give him the same lip ball back. In other words, he's showing the same, I'm ticked off, I don't want you there, whereas this bull's getting frustrated because the cow's not coming. And so he's doing everything he can at the top of his level of emotion to pull her over. If he was brave enough, he'd walk right in there and challenge the bull, but he's not. So he tries to call her back. And so anyway, this is what they're doing, is you can see their tone change, and that is what you start playing on. And that's what they're really communicating, just like your dog. He's not speaking English. When you come home and you pet your dog and he's jumping all over and you're talking real nice, hey, buddy, and you can say, hey, buddy, I'm going to kick your butt. It's the tone of the voice, not the words. And right, that's what exactly. Keeps them all jumping all over you. Well, that's what elk are doing. And if you were disappointed when you got home because your dog tore something up and you yelled at him, you could immediately see the disappointment in the dog. He's cowering down. He knows you're displeased with him. You see, it's the tone of your voice or that emotion. And that's what you're doing with the elk. Tie those together. Think of those other animals. And this is exactly how I'm hunting elk. I'm not doing anything different. I listen to that emotion, and I start working off of it, and I play it against them. Because if you want to kill elk, you must get them on the defense. You got to get them on the defense. Yeah, don't let them get you on the defense and call the shots. It may start that way, but you have to twist the table just like a football player, quarterback. Reading the defense, he changes the whole play. That's what I'm doing with the elk. If I get the elk to call all the shots, I lose that elk almost every single time. He wants me to do the action, and I can't move all the time and come to him, so I need him to do it. So I get him on the defense. I get that curiosity card played so hard in his mind that he needs to scent check that area or get a visual. And so put him on the defense. Make him make that last move. And you got him. You'll have an opportunity almost every time. So that's what you're playing with. Play with those kind of tones and emotions, and hopefully you can kind of understand that, John, of where I'm.
No, absolutely. Now that's very well described. It makes perfect sense to me. I don't want to. I kind of want to keep going deeper, but I got a couple other questions that I want to ask.
No, you go ahead.
I don't want to keep you on here for 3 hours. We're already an hour in. I want to switch gears a little bit.
Okay.
We've been talking, you know, about that. Basically, I'm going to call it the archery season, the earlier season. You know, what are some of the things you're doing? Like, how are the tactics changing? Once you start getting on that tail end of the rut, let's say, second week of October when first rifle season starts, something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, that means I'm rifle hunting.
Yeah.
And so my range has been extended quite a bit. Yeah, there's no doubt glassing comes in hugely for me. If I know my area well, one of the things I try to do, if I'm going to go out of state or into a new area, I like to see the lay of the land, John. That's my absolute number one thing. And to an extent, my topo maps will help me or aid me in a new area. And so what I'm going to look for is I'm trying to find as open an area as I can find and as many as I can see at one time from a good location point. You see, so I'm trying to get up high enough to where I get a good visual of at least 3, 4, 5, 6 different spots, even if it covers, a few hundred yards out to 3 miles away. It doesn't matter. And what I look for is I look for the areas or the routes an elk, if it's getting pressured from a trail or from roads or where most people will access from. And I try to find those areas where an elk will try to escape. And every area has them. I have a bunch of them for archery hunting where people will push elk inadvertently, and most of them don't even know the elk are there, but there was elk are sneaking through these little escape routes.
Right.
And a lot of these escape routes will cover, they'll go through these openings. Even though I'm hunting a lot of dark timber, there's just enough openings that I know where those elk usually will come through, and I can look at that on a map and find areas like that. And the larger the open, the visualness, the better chance I have of seeing them and still trying to get a shot opportunity. And if they're like 300 yards or under, I can stop them with a nervous grunt, a real harsh nervous grunt with my bugle, and even at that distance. But after that, it's pretty much a crapshoot because the sound dies down after that. But before that, oh yeah, 150, 200 yards away, I've stopped bulls running at top speed with that single grunt. Oh yeah, just stop them, just like that. And whereas
a
bugle,
that's what most people call a bark, basically.
Yeah, it's kind of like the bark, exactly. But you're not being repetitious with it. I would give one, and if it seemed like they heard it but they weren't sure, I would give it again, 10 seconds later. I'm not sitting there barking or grunting repetitiously, every half a second. No, usually just one hard one. And it's just, boom, they lock up and look. Because, you see, that ask them a question is what it does. Anytime you hear them give that nervous grunt, they're asking for a visual or an identification.
Right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And so that's why it works so well. It locks them right up, and it can give you that shot opportunity. Whereas I'm not much on a running shot like that when something's running that fast.
No,
I'd rather see him stop at least long enough and in search of what, and they do, they're looking, they're not sure exactly where it came from. They were running, but it will stop them. But these escape routes, man, I tell you, if you can get out there 2 days early before your season starts. Because a lot of people live in areas that they just can't drive 1,000 miles to come and scout something. But try to get out there 2 days early and really get a lay of the land. And yeah, I do some glassing in the morning and the evening, but I start getting a lay of the land of, okay, people are camped here. They're camped here. They're over here. Here's the trails. Here's the roads. Wow, here's a couple other little roads I'm running around. They're not even on the map. So I start looking at all this stuff. I get a lay of the land. I start going, okay, here's where the influx is going to come from. So now I look at my map and I go, okay, here's where this is and this and this. Here's where these elk, if there's elk in here and it looks good, this is where they're going to push out. And so I try to get more than one spot unless I know my area well and I know this is an escape route these elk use every year because I know my area. Now, if I don't know that area, I try to get quite a few from one sitting. Because you can do it. If you get the right location and the elevation, you can see a lot of spots at one time. That's your homework. That's what you need to do. And if there's none right there, then go further down another half a mile on your map or whatever it takes. Because these elk don't disappear. They just keep moving. They're getting pushed. And the nice thing about it is I don't like the escape route to be within, hundreds of yards where the pressure is going to start. Because they're running hard. And if I can get more into almost a half a mile away or so, then they're on their walk again. And they're just leisurely moving. They've escaped the pressure, and now they've slowed way down. So I like doing that. And like you say, mid-month of October, that's where a lot of rifle seasons start in some states. But you get into those escape routes, and you never know where elk might come from. Yeah, I hope they come up what I feel is a trail. So if I can get up there 2 days early and then look from this pressure, what I will do on one of those days, John, is now I go up into that country. It's nothing to walk in for a mile or two or three. It's a big deal. And I'm looking for the trails. I'm looking for the trails where they're leisurely. They're still using a lot of the same routes that they're using if they were going from bedding to feeding. It's that they're getting pushed now and they're running through them before they're walking through them. So right. I'm going to look for these trails. And it's not hard to find the direction they're going to come from, because when you find the trail from an obvious feeding or bedding area, the feeding areas are usually a lot lower. Bedding areas are higher. I look for the tracks that are going that direction. If I find a good trail and it's all going down, well, I know that's not their escape route coming back. So I don't put a lot of stock in that one, because many times elk won't use the same trail going in and out unless they're forced to. Most right. of the time they have one going down, one coming back, a different one. So I'm looking for those spots where I'm going to get the best visual so that I can get elk to move naturally. And many times when you're in these areas glassing and glassing and glassing, you may come across other elk that just are up there somewhere. So it's not like it's escape routes only and you're dependent on pressure. It's just another option that pressure could push elk through there. And there could be local elk in much of that vicinity. But that scouting, if I can get there a couple days early and just find some of these spots, because as a rifle hunter and hunting, you know, within 3 miles of a road or trail, which to me is nothing, that's not very far, you need to get it done in 2 days. If you don't, your hunt gets harder and harder on day 3, 4, 5, because these hunters now are starting to push in, and some of them will have, you know, stock. Some have llamas. And unless you can get really deep in there somewhere where you know you have stock and you can get in and you're going to get into areas that are unpressured, that's different. But most of us don't have that. And so I like falling on these other parameters because they pay off. You know, they just really do. A couple of the guys on the elk hunt team, they still rifle hunt, even though they bow hunt. They still rifle hunt every year because they enjoy it. You can get 2 tags here in Idaho. And one of them, his name is Larry, and Larry is just he's an elk killing machine. I don't even know how many bulls this guy's killed by himself, but it's probably over 50. And it'd be a combination and he's younger than I am. But this is how hard of a hunter he is, and he's a solo hunter. And a lot of these little things I'm talking to you about are things I've used myself and stuff I've talked to Larry about. And Larry is just an elk killing machine on over the counter bulls or draws. It doesn't matter. And he will tell you these same things. So it's not just me. It's kind of the team as a team effort. These are some of the things that we focus on. The glassing for us is huge. We will still call at that time, because there's a lot of timber out there, too, where we hunt. Yeah, there's some openings here and there from the burns or a few little meadows here and there or little parks, basins. But there's still enough timber that if the elk are in there and we can't get a visual on them, or we just hope they're in there, we will throw out a bugle. And so we're trying to get them to respond. Now, if something responds out of there, we know they're there. Now we'll go in after them and get the wind right, get the cover. And we just need to get within rifle range of them. That's all. And so we will definitely use the bugle way more than a cow call. I know a lot of people will use a cow call a lot at that time, hoping to get a response. And I have, but I find a bugle just gets way more responses. And so I like falling on it, and the cow call gets 10% use where the bugle would get 90% use.
Makes sense. Sounds like I might have to commandeer Larry for my Idaho hunt this year.
Larry is, but he does. He's not like me. He's not just pouring out. Larry is a. You ask him a question, and it's a yep. You ask him another, nope. That's Larry. He's not.
Oh, Jesus.
And he will be honest with you, but he has no PR skills, and he will tell you that. Believe me, he's a great guy, but he just does not elaborate. You need to be very specific on what you want to know. But no, we hunt a lot of the same areas. I know where he hunts. He knows where I hunt. And I mean, sometimes we're even chasing around the same elk and stuff. But as far as that, you know, in that time of year, most cases we don't have much snow, John. So it's not like, oh, why don't you just track them in the snow?
Yeah,
because there isn't much or hardly anything. And so some years there are. But then, yes, then you have that broken snow floor. And man, do elk stand out like a sore thumb then. So that's when glassing really comes into play, because you can see their trails in the snow, the areas right. they're using. You can see them, their comings and goings. You track them down if you see a freshman where it crossed a dirt road somewhere. I mean, you know, those are just obvious things. But for the most part, glassing and bugling, the two of those are still what put meat in the freezer, you know, when we do rifle hunts. And it's just, and glassing would be over bugling. Bugling would be secondary. Glassing right. would be number one, because all we need to do is find them, create an ambush, get within range, and it's just not the same as calling them in September.
No. I mean, you don't need, I mean, your range is so much longer that it's not a necessity for you to be able to draw them in all the way to you, you know.
Yeah, unless you, you know, sometimes yeah, we'll even have a spotting scope, but that usually only applies on draw units. If we're hunting right. over-the-counter bulls, the first 5 points going to get whacked.
Oh,
we're
yeah,
not out
yeah.
there trying to mess around, trying to get the biggest bull in the world.
I have no delusions of shooting a big bull. You know, I don't want to shoot a baby either, but...
Yeah. Exactly.
You know, just something mature enough that...
Yeah, a decent representation of the area. Exactly. And that always works really well. And that's Larry, too. He's shooting, you know, a 5 and a 6 or whatever. You know, he's not looking for the biggest bull out there. Unless we're hunting draw areas, and then we get pickier and let a lot of stuff go. But outside of that, oh, yeah. And rifle hunts are fun.
I've never done a quote-unquote non-rut hunt or rifle hunt even. For elk in a different state that time. So, you know, I've done quite a bit of that here in Arizona. Sure. You know, we take clients out for late rifle season all the time. And I actually, I like the late archery season here in Arizona. I've been fortunate enough to score bulls on that hunt. And it's tough. It's a tough hunt. So my out-of-state experience has all been during the rut, you know, chasing bugles, you know, everything we talked about earlier in the podcast. So for me to go out, and being from Arizona, and I don't want to sound conceited, but Arizona guys really know how to glass because of what we have to glass here. And if you're a coos deer hunter, you're a fairly good hunter. A fairly good glasser, I should say, anywhere you go. So I do want to rely on that. Like, that's a strong point for me. But I know Idaho. Well, I don't know where I'm going. I've never been in that part of the state. But everywhere else I used to hunt back in the day, I'm just thinking to myself, really, not much you can glass, or, you know. So I'm hoping that I did my homework and chose a glassable unit, and we'll have.
Well, they're all glassable. Yeah. Just some have more area. I mean, like where we are located, there is a lot of dark timber here. I mean, the dominant feature is that, but there's enough burns and enough, you know, blowdowns. You're going to see there's enough here that you can glass, and that's still number one. Yeah, we still bugle in here in October, but. No, glassing is definitely the key, even in this dark timber, because once you get the elevation and you get these little pockets, and they may only be an acre, some may be a couple of acres, some may be 25 acres, you know, it's just little spots of stuff that the elk will pass through if they're in that area where, you know, the transition area where they're going from bedding to feeding, escape, whatever. So you're just really concentrating on those spots because you can't see in the timber anyway.
Right.
But you will find them. I mean, don't think glassing isn't used in the dark timber. And even when you get in the timber, because you heard one, you know, one respond, your glass can still be used immensely, because as you move through there, you are glassing for every, are you ever? Because it's not like they're just standing there waiting for you, and you got to see them before they see you. So if you can catch a part or, you know, a cow or anything that you didn't know was there,
Right.
Looking with the wind in your face. Don't get in a hurry because you're not going anywhere. Be very, very patient. And once they're in there, they're just there. So as far as stalking them at that time, man, you better go slow.
Right.
Because if they blow out of there, trying to shoot them in the dark timber with the rifle, and they're still out there, I mean, there's just so many trees.
Right, exactly. So, yeah, threading a needle.
Are you hunting sagebrush area?
There is some sagebrush type stuff. It looks a little bit more open, like JP type stuff.
Oh,
it's okay. Kind of a good transition, but there's quite a bit of the steep, dark timber stuff too as well.
Well, they'll be bugling at that time, so that's not a problem. You just have to go where there's no pressure, mm-hmm. and find them a day or two before the season, and they'll, when nobody's hunting them, find those son of a guns where they're at vocally if you can't find them with the glass, and be the first guy there because they ain't going anywhere. That's exactly where they'll be.
I planned on doing a lot of night calling too, just because I found they get a lot braver that time of year.
Yeah.
At night. And then
that's how we find a lot of elk, period, ourselves, you know, as we do that archery season as well as rifle season. It's funny because, you can get in so much action like that. It's mind-boggling how many bulls can answer sometimes in a 15-mile stretch. And so it's a good thing to do, and especially when you're completely away from other camps, other roads, everything.
Yeah.
So,
yep.
So that sounds like you got a plan.
I'm hoping my plan pans out. We'll see. Only time will tell.
You know what? Honey, elk is like anything in this world. You get out of it what you put into it. And by, you know, being diligent, persevering, and don't give up out there, all it takes is, 15 to 30 seconds of jubilation to overcome days of frustration of seeing nothing. I mean, that's all it takes. So keep the right attitude, be positive, be confident. It'll happen. You'll see animals. You'll see them.
Yeah, I'm excited. Well, cool. I want to thank you for coming on and sharing your knowledge with us. If I can, I'd like to get you back on and we'll talk about it. There's a couple other really key points, like situations, I should say, more so than points, that I know guys get faced with a lot. Especially that one bull that is like locating, bugling, and he's walking like the ridge, and you just never see him. You can't catch up with him. That type of stuff. Mm-hmm. I want to talk about stuff like that. Maybe do a little bit more situational stuff and what you do in those situations.
Sure thing. So,
yeah, we'll get you back on and we'll talk about that stuff. But anyway,
let's do it before hunting season.
Oh, yeah,
guys can use it.
Absolutely. Now we'll get you on here shortly. Maybe in the next week or two. I would have kept on going with this, but unfortunately, I got somebody scheduled right after you.
No, you're good. No, heck, that's all right.
And I you're definitely somebody I can do. There's people that can, that have a lot of good knowledge and. But you got a good delivery on it, and it's easy to listen to you. So I could sit here for a couple hours and listen to you telling me. I'm not falling asleep. So I would have kept on if I could. But awesome. So thanks, man, for taking the time, and I'll get with you here shortly. And like I said, we'll see if we can get you back on.
All right, my pleasure. No problem.
If you guys want to check out the Elk Nut app, is awesome. I played around with it quite a bit. And you guys, your website is what? Just elknutoutdoors.com?
Yes, it is. Yes.
Okay. So yeah, the elknutoutdoors.com. And follow Paul and the crew and look at a lot of the stuff that they offer and the stuff that they're teaching. Because I mean, what I could give you here in an hour and a half on a podcast is a small piece of what they're doing, and there's so much information out there, and like I said, he does a really good job with it. So
hey guys, want to stay connected with the podcast? Check out my blog, johnstallone.me. That's www.johnstallone.me, and you could go on there. On the top right hand corner, there's a little subscribe box. Quickly put in an email address, hit subscribe, and boom, you're done. There's a lot of great information on there. A lot of posts that go hand in hand with the podcast that we do, plus gear reviews, plus we have the signature t-shirts on there, the I Eat Fast Food t-shirts, and the Tuesday Coosday shirts. It's a really good way to stay connected with the podcast. And thanks for listening.